I found some great quotes by mothers this week. Maybe some of you have heard some of these. First of all, there was a mother who said, "The most wonderful moment in a mother's life is when all the kids have gone to bed." And a second mother said, "You know, I was talking to my college roommate the other day, and I said to her, 'Do you remember when we were young and I had those three theories about raising kids? Well, now I have three kids, but no theories.'" And the third one concerned a mother of five who was asked, "If you had it all over again, would you have children?" "Oh, definitely," she said, "just not the same ones." Sorry to any kids who are in the room, okay? And one more. There was a little boy whose mother was putting him to bed the night before his fifth birthday, and she was very important to her that he understood that he was going to be five the next day. And so she said to him, "Johnny," she said, "you're four right now, right?" And he proudly held up his four fingers and he said, "Yes, Mom, I'm four." And she said, "But you know what? You're four tonight, but tomorrow when you wake up, do you know how old you're going to be?" And very proudly he added his thumb and he said, "Tomorrow I'm going to be a handful." And so we dedicate this day to all the mothers and people who have served in that mother role who've had their hands full and their handfuls, both, right? So in celebration of today, and as part of our Women in the Bible series, we're going to focus today on the most revered mother, not only in the Bible, but throughout history, Mother Mary, the mother of Jesus. And it's interesting that Mary is considered the most famous woman in the New Testament, and yet, beyond the Nativity, there's really very little about her in the Bible. We're going to do in one lesson today almost all the times that Mary is mentioned. And relax, I'm not going to hold you till 2 o'clock. It's not going to take that long, okay? The canonical Gospels really don't say much about her. They say nothing, actually, about her parentage, her birth, or how she met her husband Joseph. Nothing in the Bible about that. Actually, she and Sarah, the woman we talked about last week, share that in common, that they are the only two significant biblical women whose heritages are not included in the Bible. However, if we look beyond the canonical Bibles, if we look into the Apocrypha, the word Apocrypha is a Greek word meaning hidden away. So these are the biblical books that didn't make the cut, you might say, into the traditional Bible. So they're outside the regular canon. That's why they're called non-canonical. But according to these stories, Mary was born to aged and childless parents, Joachim and Anna. At the age of three, she was dedicated to God in the temple in Jerusalem. And she lived there until she was 12. During that time, according to those stories, she was ministered to by angels. She was very spiritual. And her betrothal to Joseph was actually the result of a miraculous sign. Now, the Gospel of Luke tells us that at the time of the Annunciation, Mary is back in her hometown of Nazareth. There's a map showing the tiny village at the time would have been about 150 people nestled in the hills of the lower Galilee region. And this is the part of Mary's story that we all know, the part about the Annunciation. We visit that every Christmas, and we talk about Mary, the young virgin, who is visited by the angel of Gabriel and is told that she will bear a son and that the son will be called the Son of the Most High. And we remember Mary's response to the angel. She says, "Here I am, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me." And then, aware of the divine life, there's Nazareth, aware of the divine life that she is carrying, she visits her cousin Elizabeth, who's also with child, and says the beautiful prayer of praise that we call the Magnificat, beginning, "My soul doth magnify the Lord. My soul doth magnify the Lord." Now, our Unity co-founder, Charles Fillmore, tells us that metaphysically, Mary represents the soul that magnifies the Lord daily in the temple, because of all the years that Mary spent in the temple, daily praying and meditating, and through its devotions prepares itself for a higher life. So Mary represents that preparation we all go through in making our lives more spiritual. And the young woman, according to Charles Fillmore, because she's a young virgin, represents the purified soul. The purified soul that becomes highly intuitive and sensitive to the intuition of the Lord, of the great I Am. Mary shows us that spiritual enlightenment comes not from the intellect, but more directly from intuition, because all the women in the Bible represent emotion and intuition, while the men represent intellect. And in truth, we all have both of those energies. But Mary spends a lot of time in quiet reflection, in prayer, and in meditation, and she receives the indwelling Christ as she ponders things in her heart. Mary also, perfect today to talk about her, because she also symbolizes the divine motherhood of love. And what is more beautiful and tender than the love and joy of a mother with an infant, looking forward to seeing him or her grow up and wonder what the child will become? One of my favorite stories that Dean sings so beautifully at Christmas time is the story, Mary, Did You Know? Mary, did you know? What a profound question that is. Certainly Mary knew that her baby boy was not to be a normal child. But did Mary know? Did Mary know that he someday would heal the sick, calm the storms, confound the Pharisees, and revolutionize thinking about the nature of God and humankind? Did Mary know? Did Mary know that along with the countless joys of motherhood, there also was to be great pain and suffering? For Mary, when we think about it, is the only human being who was present at both the birth and the crucifixion of Jesus. And the pain Mary will face eventually is forecasted, actually foreshadowed, I guess we'd say, in a story told in Luke chapter 2, verses 22 to 24. Shortly after Jesus' birth, when it comes time for Mary's purification, she and Joseph journey from Nazareth to Jerusalem to present their firstborn son at the temple. And that's according to Mosaic law, which also required that each Jewish mother undergo a period of purification after birth, and in the case of a male child, it was 40 days. After which the child was to be presented at the temple. So that's why they're here. And while they were there, they met Simeon, who was an aged priest. This is a picture of him. And they met him, and he recognized that Jesus was the Messiah. So Simeon holds Jesus in his arms, and as we read in Luke 23, then Simeon blessed them and said to his mother Mary, now this is directly to Mary, not to Joseph, says to his mother Mary, this child is destined for the falling and the rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be opposed, so that the inner thoughts of many will be revealed, and a sword shall pierce your own soul too. How prophetic about what Mary was to face at the crucifixion. And next we're told that the little family returns to Nazareth, where the child grows up and becomes strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Now we can just picture Mary, the matriarch of a loving Jewish home, mothering Jesus, caring for him day by day, teaching him the Hebrew scriptures, reprimanding him when it was necessary, as she did to all her subsequent children. For Joseph and Mary had at least six other children after Jesus, four sons and two daughters. In Mark 6:3, a group of skeptics mentioned Jesus' family. They scoffed. He's just a carpenter, the son of Mary and the brother of James. That would be the disciple James. The brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon, and his sisters live right here among us. And after that, the text says, they were deeply offended and refused to believe in him. And the only other childhood story we get about Jesus in the canonical Gospels is the story told in Luke 2, verses 29 to 52, of Jesus You all know this story. At age 12, making the yearly trip with his parents to Jerusalem once again, this time for the Feast of Passover. When the week-long festival ended, the Galilean caravan headed home, and there would have been lots of people from Galilee in the caravan. And for the first day, Mary just naturally assumes that her son is somewhere in the caravan playing with children of other relatives or friends. And when she and Joseph realize that Jesus is missing, they immediately head back to Jerusalem. I'm very worried. There she finds him, though, sitting in the temple, listening to the temple teachers and asking intelligent and perceptive questions. The text says, all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. Now remember, he's only 12 years old. But in typical mother mode, some of us have been there, in typical mother mode, Mary was indignant and chastised her son, saying, "Child, why have you treated us like this? Look, your father and I have been searching for you with great anxiety." By the way, we can see who is the disciplinarian in this family, right? It's Mary. I think every mother, every parent actually, every guardian of a child can empathize with Mary's fear and angst that her son is missing. And upon finding him safe, you know how it is, you're so worried about them and you think, oh, I'd do anything if I just see them again. And then when you find out they're someplace they're not supposed to be, you're going, what were you thinking? Where have you been? And that's her reaction. She just becomes so upset with him that he's worried and inconvenienced them so much. And Jesus says to his earthly mother and father at this point, why were you searching for me? Did you not know that I would be in my Father's house? The King James Version says, did you not know that I would be about my Father's business? Now, this is important because Elizabeth Sand Turner reminds us in her book, Your Hope of Glory, that this is Jesus' first announcement, remember, at 12 years old, of his dedication to God's service. And I would add that that must be the first time that it's recorded that Jesus publicly calls God Father, Abba, Papa, in the Greek. And you know, maybe this is also the first time, or the beginning of one of the first times, when Mary starts to know that her son is on a divine mission, that he belongs not to her, not just to her, but to God and to all humankind. And the story ends, then he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was obedient to them. His mother treasured all these things in her heart, and Jesus increased in wisdom and in years and in divine and human favor. And by the way, just as a note here, this is the last time in the Bible that we will see Joseph. And so it's assumed that he makes his transition sometime afterwards. Remember, he was much older than Mary when they married. So on the third day, well, actually, the next time, I have to say, that we have Mary directly featured in a story with her son is 18 years later. These are what are known as the lost years of Jesus' life. They weren't lost to Jesus, but they're lost to us because we don't really know what happened in between. But the story is found in John 2, verses 1 to 11. It's another familiar story. On the third day, now that would be the third day after Jesus called his disciples. On the third day after calling his disciples, there was a wedding in Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there, and both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And you all know the story. The wine ran out, and the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus answered her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not come." So his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says, you do it." And now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons of water. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." So they filled them to the brim. And then he said, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to the head waiter. He tested the water, tasted the water actually, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from. However, the servants knew because they had observed it, and we assume that the disciples also knew. The head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first. But when people have drunk freely, then he serves the poorer wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." The beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Now, we have to have a little bit of historical context here. History shows that a wedding in antiquity was an event of great importance and lavishly celebrated. And I know some of you are sitting, somebody told me today they went to a grandson's wedding last week, our son's wedding last week, actually. And I know we're all sitting here thinking, well, that's the same as it is today. It's lavishly celebrated today, too. However, in Jesus' time, the festivities often lasted for wealthy families as long as 7 or 8 days. I know. I don't know how people have the energy. And for less wealthy families, 2 or 3 days. Those people absolutely knew how to party, did they not? They knew how to party. But this particular wedding feast, as we've read, is marred because they run out of wine. Now just think, there's no Total Wine and More Street stores around the corner, right? There's no place to get the wine. The grapes are still on the vines. So Elizabeth Sann Turner tells us, as abundant hospitality was a point of honor among the Jews of Palestine, this was an embarrassing situation. Indeed, it was a disgrace. So Mary apparently feels some responsibility for this because she goes to Jesus and asks him to do something about it. This makes some Bible scholars believe that maybe it was the wedding of one of her sons or daughters. Some people have even thought that maybe it was Jesus himself's wedding. However, Jesus rebukes her, it sounds like a rebuke, when he says, "Woman, what is this to do with us?" Now, actually, it wasn't a rebuke at all, because it sounds kind of disrespectful in our language to call your mother woman, but in the days of the early Hebrews, it was a common address for women, and it was really an address of respect. And what is the meaning of Jesus' words, "My hour has not come"? Well, Unity scholar Herbert Hunt has an interesting explanation, one I really have not heard from other metaphysicians. He believes that this phrase, "my hour has not come," does not refer to the coming miracle at all. He says he thinks it comes from the custom of the day that serving the wine was given by the eldest guest first. So the bridegroom actually did the serving, but guests brought the wine to supplement and help the bridegroom out. And the custom was the eldest guest presented their wine first, which is probably why that wine was usually better. They could afford better wine. And then the younger guests, when their turn came, presented their wine. And Jesus would have been about 30, and he would have been among the youngest there. So maybe it was just inappropriate for him to take his turn at that point. But notice that Mary does anticipate that her son is going to take action. Because even though he says to her, "My time has not come," what does she say? What does she do then? She goes to the servants and says what? "Do whatever he tells you." That's exactly right. So Jesus, like a good Jewish son, eventually listens to his mother and performs the first recorded miracle in the Bible by turning the water not only into wine, but into the finest wine of the evening. So what is the meaning of this story? And what does Mary have to teach us here? What can we learn from this? Well, wine, coming from the fruit of the vine, actually symbolizes life, or life force. So the free flow of life forces is usually associated with happiness and joy, like at a wedding. However, we all know, if we're honest, that sometimes in our lives, things can happen that seem to rob us of our joy, where it's just hard to be joyful. And so Mary, the quiet, reflecting soul, representing intuition and a woman's love, seems at this point of Jesus' ministry, which is at the beginning, she seems to have an awareness of her son's power. And she doesn't moan, she doesn't groan, she doesn't wring her hands. She turns to Jesus, representing the Christ, and when the time is right, he not only heads off the wedding disaster, but he serves the guests with a quality they've never seen before. Mary teaches all of us that when appearances of lack seem to destroy our joy, we can turn our pivotal souls from the seeming problem to the Christ of our being, and then we will find we always have more than we need to navigate the situation. Aligned in Christ, we will live the good life represented by the good wine. So now, after the wedding in Cana, Mary and Jesus' brothers make their home in Capernaum. And this is a picture of Capernaum today and the ruins of Capernaum. It's where it was actually the center of Jesus' Galilean ministry. And this is at the point of the ministry when his crowds are really growing. I mean, he's beginning to cover the hills of the Sea of Galilee with crowds listening to his teachings. And on one occasion, Mary and his brothers come to the outskirts of the town seeking him. Perhaps Mary was concerned for her son's safety, because, you know, already he's beginning to aggravate the powers that be. Or maybe, like some in Galilee, she thought he was, and the Bible actually is translated with this quote, out of his mind because of his revolutionary teachings. I mean, his teachings were so different from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew Bible, that some people just didn't think he was mentally sane. So maybe she just thought her son was working too hard and needed a rest. I'm not sure. But here's what happens. From Mark 3, we read, then Jesus' mother and brothers arrived. Standing outside, they sent someone to call him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they told him, your mother and brothers are outside looking for you. And he replied, who are my mother and brothers? And then he looked at all those who were gathered around him at his feet, and he said, here are my mothers and brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. Ouch! Ouch to Mary, if he means that literally. It certainly seems like Jesus is denying his family of origin and recognizing only his followers, doesn't it? And it could be hurtful to his mom then. However, Elizabeth Sand Turner says, this is a short-sighted interpretation of this story, because we have to think about the fact that in Jewish society at the time, nothing was more important than family. And Turner says, Jesus is demonstrating here the idea of expanded family, showing us that ties of common belief and spiritual truth are sometimes as strong as blood. His words give no indication that he refused to see his mother and brothers, or that he loved them any less because he felt this deep spiritual kinship with what we might call his spiritual family. And Jesus understands that family demands can never take precedent over our spiritual commitment. They can enrich it, but not take precedent over it. This story may reveal, actually, I need to say this, Jesus is on a mission here, and he cannot let anyone, not even his own mother, detail him from that mission. I'm sure if Mary had her way, there would have been no crucifixion. What mother would want to see a child go through that? And although this story might be a place where it reveals Mary's misunderstanding of the whole mission, it also shows her love, her care, and her concern for him. She was simply being a mother here. And I think that touches all of our hearts. We can identify with her. And perhaps the greatest testimony about Jesus' close and loving relationship with Mary is at the crucifixion. John tells us that Mary was present, standing close to the cross, a witness to her son's anguish. What a devastating moment that was for the woman who had given him birth. And according to John, chapter 19, verses 26 to 27, when Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved, being John, beside her, he said to his mother, woman, here is your son. And then he said to this disciple, here is your mother. So from that hour, the disciple took her into his own home, and the record shows that that's where Mary remained for the rest of her life. So one of Jesus' final acts before his death was to see that his mother was cared for. And to me, that shows the bond between them. So the only further mention of Mary in the entire New Testament is after the Ascension, when Mary and Jesus' brothers join the 11 in prayer as they await the Holy Spirit. And this is in Acts 1:14. They all join together constantly in prayer, along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. And so Mary is in the company of those who are filled with the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. At last, Mary knows. And Edith Dean, in her book, All the Women of the Bible, wrote of Mary, though she never traveled any farther than from Palestine to Egypt, and then by donkey, her story still travels to the farthest corners of the earth today. And I think as we just review who Mary was, we know that she was a humble village maiden who loved her son unconditionally, even though she did not always understand him. How many of us with adult children can say that? We don't always understand our kids, but we need to let them be, right? Her love and loyalty to him are evidenced throughout his life, but especially with being with him at the very end, something the disciples, possibly with the exception of John, did not have the courage to do. So the portrait of Mary in the New Testament is one of a deeply spiritual woman who understood her life's mission to magnify the presence of God, and she knew she was on this earth to serve as God's expression, and she invites every single one of us to do the same. So as we prepare now for our time of prayer and meditation, let us affirm the great truth about our God, that there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.